Putin. He's everywhere you look in Sochi. Today, February 18th, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, there's still plenty going on at the Sochi Games, and presiding over it all with something of a smile is Russian President Putin.
Putin tries to show that he's very open, and he doesn't hate anyone. He and Russia in general respects every country, especially at the Olympics.
We'll also check in on the women's giant slalom event. One of the competitors is a classically trained violinist.
She looked brave, considering where her skill level is.
And what it's like for an actor to inhabit the role of Zimbabwe's strongman, Robert Mugabe.
I have to go behind the mask and into the psyche of this individual and try to present him in a way that is human.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're on the home stretch now for the Sochi Olympics. We've seen bobsleds flip and ice dancers twizzle. It's all been quite a show. And so far, not the disaster that many predicted. Even members of the punk band Pussy Riot showed up this week. We've been checking in with Yekaterina Kravtsova. She's covering the games in Sochi for the Moscow Times, and she says the mood there is upbeat.
Well, yes, I think most of the visitors are pretty happy about what's going on here and pretty satisfied with the organization of the Olympics in general. So, yeah, it seems like it's going better than one thought it would be.
What about you? At the beginning, were you a little skeptical? And now this far into the Olympics, did you sort of find yourself thinking, hey, this is kind of fun?
Well, yeah, probably. But for me, I mean, I've been walking around Sochi pretty much and just talked to ordinary people. And so I was really surprised by their life here. I mean, they are not so happy about the Olympics. But this side of the Olympics is not very obvious.
So, Yekaterina, what do you make of the two members of Pussy Riot coming to Sochi?
I think they just showed that there is actually this another life in Sochi, that all the protests are prohibited. Human rights activists are still being prosecuted even during the games. But Pussy Riot are just very famous. That is why everyone just paid attention to them. And they grabbed all the headlines in international media as well. But there are so many human rights and environmental activists who are being arrested in Sochi, and no one pays attention to that.
Vladimir Putin has been everywhere, it seems. How is he being portrayed?
As I've seen, when he was at the U.S. hospitality house in the Olympic Park, he was welcomed pretty good there. I mean, athletes seem to be happy to see him. So, yeah, he probably just tries to be a person who welcomes everyone in his country for this great sport celebration, as he wanted to show that Russia is open for everyone, for every country, even for the U.S. So yeah.
Yes, I know he visited the Netherlands hospitality house. You mentioned the U.S. Are these kind of public appearances with Olympians, you know, Russian Olympians, but also hanging out with Olympians from other countries, is that out of the ordinary for Putin?
I think yes. I mean, Putin tries to show that He's very open, and he doesn't hate anyone. He and Russia in general respects every country, especially at the Olympics. But I think this is pretty usual behavior for him. He's also nice with everyone, I mean, publicly. So it's pretty common that we could expect from him. So yes, I think it's just normal behavior for him.
And finally, for the people of Sochi, do you think that they're, in these last final days, are they kind of looking forward to the end of this, or are they still basking in hosting the Olympics?
Well, as I said, there are different people, those who came to Sochi for the Olympics, and some of them came just like yesterday for the last few days of the Olympics, trying to catch that Olympic mood. While, like, Sochi residents, ordinary people, they told me that they were waiting for this Olympics to be over so that their life became normal again. And they hope that after the Olympics, authorities finally find time for them to solve these issues that arise during the preparations for the Olympics.
Yekaterina Kravtsova is covering the games in Sochi for the Moscow Times. Thank you so much, Yekaterina.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Bye.
But in the meantime, the games are still on, and the women's giant slalom event today had people talking about the skier who came in first and the one who finished dead last. The skiers fought through snow, rain, and fog, but in the end, Tina Maz of Slovenia won her second gold at Sochi. Nathaniel Vinton is covering alpine skiing at Sochi for the New York Daily News. He's a former racer himself, and he recently profiled Slovenia's golden girl.
She's got a new coach. She built her whole season around these Olympics, and she's just a terrific racer who's spent a lot of time getting her form perfect.
Now, she's strong in all four alpine disciplines, slalom, giant slalom, super G, and downhill. How unusual is that?
It's pretty unusual. There's only three or four athletes at any given time that can do that. It takes a long time to build up all of those skills, and it really takes careful planning because you're going to races constantly and you're not getting much time to train in different events.
Now, Maz is from Slovenia. It's a tiny little country. It used to be part of Yugoslavia. It's done pretty well at the Olympics, 5 medals. What goes on there?
Well, they're crazy about skiing there. She's from very close to the Austrian border in a pretty mountainous area. And she's from a little town, and it's got a tiny little ski hill there. I visited it last year, and it's small and it's very primitive, but you can do a lot of skiing there. It was right next to her home.
As I understand it, Tina Maz switched her coach about a month before the Olympics. What prompted that?
Well, she wasn't having great results in December, and something was wrong, and she decided to get this coach sort of out of semi-retirement. He was working for Swiss television and came in as a sort of emergency measure to get her back on track. I think their relationship is mainly mental. It's not that he's changing her technique in any dramatic way whatsoever. It's more motivating her and helping her make the right decisions about what kind of training to do when and so forth.
Now, there is a story about the person who finished dead last today, Vanessa Mae Vanhakorn, the name she's using for the Olympics. Her father is from Thailand, so she's skiing for Thailand, but she's really a world-class violinist. Did you see her race?
I did. I saw her race. I even saw her inspecting the course before the first run.
And apparently she is a far better musician than she is a skier. How did she look out there?
She looked brave, considering where her skill level is. She finished dead last, and it wasn't an easy day. It was raining and foggy, so I'd say she looked pretty good, all things considered.
Well, it turns out Tina Maz is also a musician. Listeners can judge whether she'd get the gold for this. Nathaniel Vinton is covering the Sochi Olympics for the New York Daily News. Nathaniel, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Tina Maz of Slovenia singing with her skis in hand. We're going to move away from the Sochi Olympics now to something a little closer to home. We hear a lot about the graying of America, but the rising number of aging immigrants in the U.S. is a huge demographic trend. Some elderly immigrants hit obstacles when it comes to finding and maintaining community. That's especially true of aging Koreans here. As part of our Global Nation coverage, Bruce Wallace reports from New York.
There's not much out of the ordinary at this McDonald's in a heavily immigrant part of Queens in New York City. Customers stream in, mostly Koreans and Latinos, getting coffee and breakfast. Soft rock plays in the background. But this particular McDonald's made headlines recently.
The sign on the door advises customers to keep visits to 20 minutes. But the franchisee in this densely Korean neighborhood says they ignore it and take up table space for hours while ordering little.
Police were called in to toss out a group of elderly Koreans. They were just hanging around too long. The sides finally reached an agreement about when and how long customers could linger. Pak Ilho was sipping coffee and reading a newspaper with his friends at the McDonald's recently. He said he didn't understand why the cops got involved and found the media coverage embarrassing for Koreans. Pak and his friends say this McDonald's is a great meeting spot. There are windows that look out on a bustling intersection and a Korean grocery and church nearby. A few tables away, Jung Hyun Suk, who's 77, had a lot to say about what happened here. But when I asked why she didn't hang out at a nearby Korean center, she called over to a woman sitting nearby, asking her where the senior center was. She'd never heard of it.
Most practitioners in the senior services world say that there are a lot of services available, but the problem is that immigrant seniors just aren't reaching out or aren't able to access them in one way or another.
Christian Gonzalez Rivera is at the Center for an Urban Future, a New York think tank. He's researched immigrant seniors in New York City and found that language barriers can make it hard for these seniors to access help that is available. It's especially true for Koreans. They're the least proficient in English of all New York's elderly immigrants. It's partly because many moved here later in life.
So a combination of having arrived here late and therefore not assimilating into American culture, not being able to speak the language, and being concentrated in their own enclave means that they've had very little contact with opportunity outside of their community.
At the Bronx Korean American Senior Center, about a 30-minute drive from the McDonald's in Queens, the weekly computer class is just getting started. Five Korean seniors hunt tentatively around the keys. Most of them live near the center, a small space tucked in the back of a plain brick building. But Andrew Suh comes here from New Jersey, an hour and a half trek by bus and subway. He says the senior center near his home doesn't cater to Koreans. I asked him why he's working on his computer skills.
I like writing and email. And today I want to open Facebook.
He likes emailing and now Facebook. They help him connect with people in Korea. This center opened 20 years ago and stays afloat with a small grant from the Korean American Community Foundation. It's a big help for the 30 or so people who drop by most weeks. Along with computer classes, there's also English and dance, and a Korean lunch. Abraham Lee, the center's director, would love to do more, but says money is hard to come by. Going for big grants or government help means lots of bureaucracy and English expertise. And bigger donors hesitate to fund small groups. The Korean Foundation just launched a fellowship that pairs young Koreans with groups like Lee's, hoping that together they can solve the funding puzzle. Like the people at McDonald's, computer student Andrew Suh was eager to talk, and he wanted to practice English. He says he's always checking English books out of the library.
A lot of American books. Yeah, I want to every books and one reading, but my English was no good. Yeah, my ability no good.
But he's committed.
And until my dying, English, you'll conquer.
He says before he dies, he's going to conquer English. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, New York City.
You can always get the latest from our newsroom. Just follow us on Twitter. We're at PRI The World. And as you may know, I edit the global cartoons section of The World Online. I keep an eye out for the sharpest commentary from cartoonists around the globe, including several recent cartoons addressing Russia's anti-gay laws and the Olympics. Follow me on Twitter at Global Cartoons or find my posts on our Tumblr page. That's at pri.tumblr.com. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Robert Mugabe is turning 90 this week. He's been ruling Zimbabwe since 1980, and he's showing no signs of wanting to retire. To his critics, Mugabe is a revolutionary turned tyrant. But to his psychiatrist, Dr. Parrish, he's just another patient. Or at least that's the premise of the off-Broadway play Breakfast with Mugabe. In the play, Mugabe seeks out a therapist to deal with a bout of depression. Michael Rogers is the actor who plays Mugabe.
The script was sent to me, and I took a long time to read it because I was familiar with Rhodesia / Zimbabwe most of my life and I did not feel that anyone would write an honest play about that situation. And when I finally read it, I was very excited and thought, wow, this should be seen and we ought to do this. It's a fantastic role. It was, to me, as exciting as getting a classical Shakespearean part, which I've done lots of. So I thought, oh, how wonderful that this is now in the canon.
You're originally from Trinidad and Tobago. Did you grow up learning about Zimbabwe?
Yes, ma'am. Yes. Ever since I was a child, I knew all about Rhodesia. Of course, we knew of the Rhodes Scholars. Maybe it's because we were a British colony. And when the war came, I was very familiar with the war, very familiar as what was going on in Rhodesia. We had a calypsonian who had a popular calypso about Ian Smith in Trinidad. That calypsonian's name was Cypher. It pokes fun, but at the same time is trying to make a point. And that calypso did make a point that I've never forgotten to this day.
And what was the point did it make to you?
Well, the point that it made to me that there was something was desperately wrong in that part of the world. And there was a leader who was behaving in a particular way that was not human, per se, and that there should be some reaction to him. That was what basically the calypso was singing about. It would say things like, where does Ian Smith get this power to hold Rhodesia? Why is he able to do this? And I thought, that's very interesting. And as a child, you know, you're just hearing these songs, you're singing them, you're repeating them. And later, as time went on, I understood more and more about what was going on there and about the apartheid that was happening, not only in Rhodesia, but also in Zambia, which was then northern Rhodesia.
So I'm curious, with that calypso, you associated it with Ian Smith, of a person who had to go. Now, all these years later, do you link it now to Robert Mugabe as a leader who really should go?
Well, the wonderful thing about being an actor is that you get to do a lot of research. Most of my time is spent reading when I'm not actually working on the stage. And when you do a lot of reading, and also I used to be a history student, you understand that nothing begins right now, that everything is a continuum, that there were things happened in the past that caused things to happen right now. So even someone like Robert Mugabe, he is a part of a continuum. It's a reaction to something that has happened a long time ago. And there will be reactions to him.
How did you prepare for the role?
Many years ago, in 1988, I went to Zimbabwe. I didn't know I'd get to use it many years later. But I've done a lot of travel, and I continue to do a lot of travel.
What took you to Zimbabwe in 1988?
My best friend at Yale, I was in the School of Drama, and one of my best friends there was in the School of Art, and he was from Zimbabwe. And we both graduated at the same time. And he said, you must come home. And I said, of course, that's Rhodesia, it's become Zimbabwe. And all the Rhodes Scholars, I definitely want to go to Zimbabwe with the first chance I get. And in 1988, I had that opportunity to cover the country from Mashingo to Nyanga. And it was quite an interesting experience for me because I wasn't like a tourist, because I was with my friend and who took me to every nook and cranny that we could discover. And I learned a great deal. And thankfully now it's helping me in this part.
Has your Zimbabwean friend seen you perform in Breakfast
Actually,
with Mugabe?
Yes, he has helped with the language because he happened to be in New York while we were rehearsing. And he has seen me perform in it, and he knows the play very well, and he's very excited.
What are some of Mugabe's hang-ups in the play?
In the play, it is believed he is haunted by a spirit called a Ngozi, which is a malevolent spirit, someone who has died in bitterness or anger. And he is being haunted by this spirit. So he calls in a psychiatrist, a white psychiatrist, to help him manage this illness. And it all comes down to his own conscience and about what he thought. Because, you know, we are our own worst enemies in certain respects. When our minds and our conscience haunt us, nothing anyone outside of ourselves can tell us can be as demanding or as painful as our own conscience. And so in this play, he is haunted by this consciousness, this spirit of this dead person. And that is the most difficult thing for him to have to handle, because his entire belief system is being shattered.
Do you know if Robert Mugabe knows about this play?
I'm sure he does. This play was a very popular play in London when it was first done. It's been very popular here with us also. And many people from the embassy in New York have come to see it. And if they've come, of course he knows about it. I myself, I would think I'd be flattered if someone's written a play about me, as balanced as this is.
In the press in the U.S., any news about Mugabe in Zimbabwe is usually negative. Robert Mugabe is largely considered someone who should have left power a long time ago, who's driven his country into economic ruin. Did you come away from this play, or do you come away with it, with a more nuanced view of the man?
I hope so. I hope I'm able to give a performance that gives you a different aspect of his life as opposed to just the propaganda, because as an actor, the propaganda doesn't help me at all. I have to go behind the mask and into the psyche of this individual and try to present him in a way that is human. Because, as you know, everyone thinks he or she is doing the right thing. Everyone loves their children, their wife, their family, you know, and is trying to do what they think is right. And like I say, he is part of a continuum. Eh? Something has happened in the past that has caused him to react this way. And something will happen in the future that will cause someone to react to him. When I was beginning the work on this, I thought a great deal about Toussaint Louverture in Haiti, when he won that war against the Spanish, the French, and the English. And as a result of that, he has been hated ever since. And his country, Haiti, has maintained itself as one of the poorest countries in the world. And this is not an unusual pattern. I see this in many, many, many of the readings that I've done, where certain people have made choices. And then when those choices have come back to haunt them, whoever dares to stand up against those choices is destroyed. I think that's a human thing. What I've discovered is there's a little Mugabe in us all.
Actor Michael Rogers is currently playing Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe in the off-Broadway play Breakfast with Mugabe. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me, Carol.
A quick update now on a story we told you about yesterday. Students at the University of Glasgow were in search of a new rector at the school. One group nominated NSA leaker Edward Snowden for the job.
We admire his courage. He's given up everything in order to expose what he felt and what we feel are immoral and corrupt practices.
That's Chris Castles, one of the students behind the effort to get Snowden elected. Well, after 2 days of voting, the students have spoken. Edward Snowden is the new rector of Glasgow University. He's got temporary asylum in Russia, so he probably won't take up the post in person. That's okay. The role is largely symbolic. The students who nominated him say he should be able to fulfill his duties from a distance. If you're wondering who Snowden was up against in the voting, a former champion cyclist, an author, and a local vicar. This is PRI. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, a professor at Wellesley College here in Boston steps up to bat for a fired colleague in China.
We are interested in the struggles that he is leading in China along with other dissidents, and we are going to support him.
Plus, the sport of chess boxing, which is pretty much just what it sounds like.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. American universities are going through a great expansion, opening campuses in many parts of the world. Partly it's to attract students from places where they pay full tuition. Partly it's to offer American students opportunities for study abroad. And partly it's to engage in the global exchange of ideas. That last reason is exciting, but it can also be fraught with complications. The World's Matthew Bell reports on a professor at a Chinese university who lost his job, and the professors at an American college who tried to help him.
Chinese economics professor Xia Yiliang never held back during his 13 years at Peking University. He criticized the Chinese government in the classroom, in publications, and on social media. Then 6 years ago, he helped draft a document called Charter 08. It called for an end to China's one-party rule under the Communist Party. To say that the national leadership did not take kindly to such an open challenge would be an understatement. Xia's co-signer and Nobel Prize winner, Liu Xiaobo, is currently serving an 11-year prison sentence. Professor Xia says officials at Peking University made it clear that he was also heading for trouble.
They have their talks with me for several times and have their warnings. They say, if you keep doing this, you'll lose your job someday.
Fast forward to last summer, and Xia was pretty sure that he was about to be fired. That was when he visited Wellesley College outside of Boston. Wellesley had recently begun an educational partnership with Peking University. During Xia's visit, he talked about his situation with Wellesley faculty. Some of them felt compelled to offer Xia support, so they wrote an open letter urging Peking University not to fire him for political reasons. 140 faculty members signed it. They warned that firing Xia because of his beliefs could jeopardize the partnership between the two institutions.
It became clear to me that this guy was the object of what was looking like a political purge.
Tom Cushman is a professor of sociology at Wellesley. He helped draft the letter in support of Xia, and Cushman says it sent an important message to Peking University and, by extension, the Chinese government.
We've met this person. He's our colleague. You know, we are interested in the struggles that he is leading in China along with other dissidents, and we are going to support him precisely to show that Wellesley is a pluralistic and open space. The terms of academic discourse cannot be dictated, you know, from Beijing about what we're going to talk about and what we're going to say and do.
The letter didn't work. Xia was fired last fall. Peking University said the reason was poor teaching. A university official said that politics had nothing to do with the decision to get rid of Xia. Some of his former students were quoted in news stories saying that he was indeed a bad teacher. But Xia says his former boss admitted to him that this was not a simple matter of poor job performance.
At first, she mentioned it's a pure academic issue. It's not a political one. It has nothing to do with politics. But later on, she said, you think we all have to listen to American professors? Do you think they really helped you? Probably they just exploited you. And if you haven't made them to do so, probably your situation would not be like this.
So did the American faculty at Wellesley overstep their role as partners with Peking University? Tom Cushman says absolutely not.
It's one of the oldest tricks in the authoritarian playbook to say that we're persecuting this dissident because Westerners are interfering in our business. You know, that just gives up the game because it shows that the bad teaching thing was a lie, but also, you know, indicates that they're doing it in retaliation, you know, for his perfectly legitimate efforts to reach out to his colleagues in the United States.
Things could have turned out worse. Xia has taken up a new position at the Cato Institute in Washington. He will also be an associate at Wellesley's Freedom Project and plans to work on a book with Cushman. The budding partnership between Wellesley College and Peking University is intact. But there might be some important lessons learned here. Orville Schell runs the Center for U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York. He says the repression of dissenters by China's government should not be an excuse to cut off cooperation altogether.
That won't work because we're too deeply involved in a kind of a global world where trade, nuclear proliferation, climate change, other questions, pandemics, very much depend on our ability to work with China.
But Schell also applauds the faculty at Wellesley for taking a stand and not compromising on their values.
So we're left with a tremendously difficult dilemma where sometimes we do need to stand on our principles and we do need to rebuke challenges to those principles. And sometimes we have to find a way to, you know, continue the dialogue and continue some kind of constructive relationship.
Things won't get any easier for American universities as some experts see China's current government intensifying its crackdown on dissent. For the World, I'm Matthew Bell.
It's hard to turn around these days without running into another situation where something that's happening in China is changing the way we do business here in the U.S. So here's another one. It has to do with trash and a recent decision by China to crack down on the kinds of supposedly recyclable material being sent there from the United States. The World's Jason Margolis brings us the story from Los Angeles.
Susan Collins wants to correct a fairy tale many of us like to believe about recycling.
The public has been trained to put their stuff in their bin at their curb and for the stuff to just go away. And of course, there is no such thing as away. Away is always somewhere.
Somewhere, for more than a decade, has most often been China. Collins is the president of the Container Recycling Institute in Los Angeles. She says that China has made a lot of money reprocessing our junk and selling the raw materials. But around a quarter of the bottles, cans, and paper we were sending there were mixed in with too much food or other trash to actually be recycled. So they ended up in landfills. Last year, China decided it had had enough of being the world's trash dump. They enacted a new policy they call the green fence.
And they would reject shipments at ports if they were too contaminated. So from the perspective of the recyclers that were operating in the United States, that meant that they had paid money and put materials on a ship. The materials came back to them, which meant that they didn't receive the revenue from selling the scrap materials.
That meant trouble for many American recycling companies in the short term. But Collins says China's green fence quickly began pushing big changes in the business.
This has sort of raised the bar for everybody and has said to everybody, slow everything down a little bit so that you get everything sorted properly, produce higher quality materials. There are buyers in the United States that will buy that material.
One of those buyers in the U.S. is Carbon Light Recycling near Los Angeles.
We are just entering our facility here, and we're going to go through how we take bales of plastic bottles and transform it into finished good.
Carbon Light CEO Leon Farinick showed me around the company's plastic bottle reprocessing plant in Riverside, California. Bottles come in and get ground down into flakes.
Goes to a complete wash line, like your laundry at home, but much more sophisticated.
They process about 2 billion bottles a year here. Inside a laboratory, samples of the finished product are tested for purity. Farinick holds up a bag of small plastic pellets, which he sells to soda bottlers.
This definitely will make you several bottles.
Farinick's factory has been running under capacity. He's excited about China's green fence. A lot of those bales of plastic that used to get shipped to China are now coming to him. In this case, better standards from China mean better practices and more jobs here in the U.S.
I would say it's always a good thing that you have to think of ways of reusing your own material. Because it's a resource. We shouldn't be giving away our resources to somewhere else when we can use it ourselves.
And Farinick says recycling plastic also means big savings in energy and greenhouse gas pollution.
I use 1/8 of the energy of a virgin material, and I save 60,000 tons just in this factory. That's like, what did we say, 40,000 trips between Los Angeles and New York on an aeroplane.
Of course, players in the global economy are always adjusting in search of the lowest cost option. So this story could yet take a dark turn. With China tightening its controls on imported trash, what's to stop Americans or Europeans from just sending their old bottles and cans to the next country down the line, say in Africa? Again, Susan Collins.
I think that is already happening, but it's not Africa, it's probably India.
As well as Vietnam and Turkey. But Collins says these countries also know what China did erecting its green fence. And she hopes other countries will follow that example and only accept recyclables that can actually be recycled. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
In the eyes of the U.S., China doesn't always set an example. In fact, the U.S. often complains that China and some other nations steal U.S. technology. But in the early days of the United States, the shoe was apparently on the other foot. We're going to take a look at America's era of technological piracy with our resident history buff, Chris Wolf. And Chris, give us an example.
Well, one nice example, Carol, is a guy called Andrew Mitchell, who sent to the UK in 1787 to try and acquire textile technology. Making clothes is the cash cow of the 18th century, the late 18th century. The Brits were way ahead in technological innovation, and the Americans wanted a slice of the pie.
So who sent him?
A guy called Tench Cox, who was a colleague of Alexander Hamilton, who was the Secretary of the Treasury. Most of the American enterprise at that time was kind of privately driven, but state-sponsored in the way that Hamilton, as Secretary of the Treasury, had positioned America, for example, to have a patent law and to give kind of dubious patents to any immigrants who might come in with technology, and they would like take ownership of the ideas that they'd stolen, pretty much, and would get a U.S. patent for it so that they could profit. It was one of the ways they would try and lure immigrants into the country with technology.
And was Andrew Mitchell successful?
He succeeded insofar as he got drawings, he got models of various carding machines, which were one of the processes in the textile industry that the Brits were ahead on. But he was caught trying to get on a ship. His trunk was impounded, and he had to flee for his life and ended up running to Copenhagen.
Ooh, so it was an attempt at industrial piracy that failed.
Correct. And the Brits were really mad. This is one of the things that they were really incensed over the early Republic. And they had very stiff laws against emigration of skilled workers and to try and prosecute anybody who was caught trying to solicit illegal immigrants or to steal technology.
So any successful attempts by the U.S. to steal industrial technology?
Yeah, I think the most famous one would be Francis Cabot Lowell, a familiar name in Massachusetts, who spent a couple of years in England studying the textile industry and committed to memory everything he'd seen, and then with a clockmaker in Waltham, started rebuilding these machines that he had kind of memorized, and they set up one of the first textile weaving mills in Waltham, and then eventually got together with some other Boston businessmen and founded the city of Lowell just to make clothes.
And did the Brits ever find out that their technology had been stolen?
Yeah, they were generally protesting all the time. In fact, the British consul in Philadelphia once bought 4 carding machines. The guys had managed to smuggle them out, but they were happier to sell them at a profit again to the British consul, who shipped them back to the UK to try and stop the technological flow.
Wow. So what was the point of all this?
Well, it's kind of like the Chinese today. They say it's national security. We need an industrial base to make America strong, and we also need a strong capital base. Hamilton had this great idea that critics would say he just wanted to make his friends rich. He argues that he had this vision of trying to create a capitalist class in the new U.S. that could fund major manufacturing projects like this and take the country forward.
Wow. Pretty interesting. Chris Wolf with this week's World That Was. Thanks so much, Chris.
You're welcome, Carol.
Here's a first for Saudi Arabia. The English-language Saudi Gazette has named a new editor-in-chief, and she's a woman.
Very surprised. I honestly didn't see it coming.
That's Samaya Jabarti. Her appointment was announced on the Gazette's website this past weekend. It's a big deal in a country where women are required to have male minders and aren't permitted to drive, and where men and women don't mix in public unless they're related. Jabarti tells the BBC it wasn't easy rising in the ranks to the top editor's post.
It's been very difficult to have managing editors in general, be them the men, to rise up to the position of editor-in-chief. We have editor-in-chiefs who have been around or in their positions for 48 years. So it's been a difficult border to cross.
Which is why her appointment took even Jabarti by surprise.
I know things have moved forward in the kingdom and things are opening up for Saudi women in general, but I really thought there was a lot yet to go until women penetrated the very much male-dominated bastion of editor-in-chief.
Jabarti says she's been lucky to work in an environment that's different from what many other Saudis experience.
We were not even segregated in our newsroom. I mean, I've been fortunate enough over the past 13 years to have an editor-in-chief who was quite a progressive thinker. So we never had a woman's section or a men's section. It's been one newsroom with all of us in it. I'm one of the lucky ones because I do know that other Saudi women working in the media have not been as fortunate.
Her newsroom includes female reporters, but male editors represent most of the staff. Jabarti says she views her appointment as a big step forward for women in the kingdom.
I think with this decision, you know, serious ground has been broken.
You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Right now, much of the focus at Sochi is following the rocks. The curling rocks, that is. Okay, not really, but the men's and women's semifinals will be happening tomorrow. The men's matchup will see 2010 gold medalists Team Canada facing relative newcomers China. And it's going to be a tough day for Canadian curling fans because one of Canada's best curlers is coaching the Chinese team. Marcel Roch is a 3-time world champion and a legend in Canadian curling. He left his hometown of Edmonton, Alberta, to take the Chinese team to Sochi. Jim Pringle is Executive Director of the Alberta Curling Federation.
Marcel was hired by the Chinese mid-summer last summer to go over and work with their respective teams looking towards Sochi and maximizing, I think, what they achieved on the ground there.
So Marcel Roch has quite a record himself. He won 4 Canadian championships and 3 world titles in curling. Is there a sense of sort of dismay in Canada that he's gone off to coach the Chinese, or are they all kind of championing what he's doing?
It's a bit odd to see him with a different color uniform at the international level. But there's been lots of precedent in regards to Canadian coaches and players working with other countries on an international basis. And certainly he's not the first. We've got J.D. Lind from Alberta is actually working with the Japanese women, and he's in Sochi as well. And we've had a number of other coaches who have also been hired to go over and work with different countries and different teams. So it's nothing outside the norm, I guess.
So I'm curious, when Canadian coaches take on other countries' curling teams, do they still train in Canada?
Well, it's a combination of both. So I think that certainly the majority of what we would call major bond spiels are throughout Canada from the end of September to early December. And it's certainly normal now to see a number of the international teams here competing in those major bond spiels. So they use a combination of training at home and then coming over here and using both the facilities to train and, of course, the various competitions to work towards the international Olympics and World Championships.
So is it true that these international teams still use the English calls in curling?
There are some curling calls or phrases that don't translate very well. So you'll certainly hear all teams using certain phrases in English. Certainly one that probably everybody uses is hurry hard, that the English is used for that. Doesn't matter whether it's the Koreans or the Swiss or the Canadians. That's one that is used by everybody during the course of a game.
So a big matchup tomorrow, a Canadian and Chinese men's curlers go at it in the semifinals. How do you feel about Marcel Roch?
Well, I mean, I think from a curling fan perspective, everybody hopes it's as good a game as they had in the round robin. It was high quality. It was outstanding curling. And I think that everybody's hoping for more of the same. I'm sure if you talk to all of the curling fans, in, whether it be in Edmonton or in Canada, this is one time that they're going to hope that the red and white and the maple leaf are victorious.
Well, you're being very diplomatic. Thank you so much, Jim Pringle, the executive director of the Alberta Curling Federation. He's been talking to us about a famous Canadian curler, Marcel Roch, who is coaching the Chinese men's and women's curling team. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Before we head out today, here's a sport that's not in the Olympics. Not yet, anyway. It's kind of like playing checkers and then getting kung fu kicked in the head. Welcome to chess boxing. Chess as in knight takes rook, boxing as in Mike Tyson. A perfect combination, it seems, for this week's Sideways Glance. From Spain, here's the world's Jerry Haddon with a story that will definitely make you look twice.
Chess boxing is, well, it's insane. Ding, round one. 4 minutes of chess. Round two, punch the lights out of the guy in front of you. Round three, sit down again, your own bell rung, and try to remember where you left your rook, and so on for 11 rounds.
You have to be focused. Keep the two sports separate.
That's Jonathan Rodriguez, near world champ.
In boxing, when you suffer, you have to be mentally cold. It's the same in chess. When you sit down at the board, your pulse drops following the physical exertion of the fight. But actually, it spikes again as you play because chess is stressful. These two sports have a lot in common. The big difference is that chess doesn't hurt.
Rodriguez is training at the gym. 3 to 4 hours of... and at least two more at the chessboard. Rodriguez says when he was growing up, he didn't even like chess.
My older brother taught me when I was a kid. I got turned off from chess because he was constantly making me play with him.
And his brother was better. And that's the thing about Rodriguez. He's not great at chess, not a master anyway. At boxing, well, he's pretty good. But as an amateur, he didn't make the Olympic team. He's lost his only two professional bouts to date. But when he combines the two sports, it's like he transforms, becomes more than their sum, becomes world class.
If you're quite good in a couple of sports, you still might never become a champion either. But joining these two might just be the combination I'm looking for. Like a sprinter who's good at the 100 meter and the 200 meter, his optimal race might be somewhere in between.
Rodriguez is 2-0 at his new game, and last fall he qualified in a tournament in Germany to compete in chess boxing's annual world championships. At the Moscow tourney in November, Rodriguez made it to the finals.
There were mostly Germans and Russians. I was the special one, the Spaniard. In international sport, we're known for other things.
Like hoops and soccer, Rodriguez lost the championship match on points. He didn't hit the mat, he didn't lose his king. And he didn't lose his head switching back and forth from the mental to the physical.
Rompes un poco el tópico del ajedrecista que es el friki que está en casa que no sale del tablero y el boxeador.
We're helping to break the stereotypes here, that the chess player is the weirdo at home who never leaves his chessboard, and the boxer is the aggressive one going around smashing faces. In all aspects of life, you have to be quite cerebral. That goes for chess and for boxing. You have to be able to make decisions, be in your head.
Boxing isn't just for meatheads. Chess isn't just for brainiacs. Mix the two. You'll see. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, León, Spain.
And it's a right hook to the jaw and a rook to b3. We've got a great video of chess boxing in action. That's at PRI.org. Somos lo que somos. And if boxing or chess isn't your thing, how about mixing backgammon and dance? Just asking. In any event, we'll leave you with new music from Spain just released today. The group is Jarabe de Palo. We'll dance out to the title track, Somos. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow. La tierra enferma y tú con ella, bro. Mira al hombre arrasa con todo lo que le dio. Digo paz, verdad, justicia, libertad. Digo amor, respeto, conciencia, dignidad. Mira, somos lo que somos, no lo que queremos. Patrones, esclavos humanos, imperfectos. Somos rata, cultura, humanidad. Somos lo que somos. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.